طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we hear a presentation by the eminent Palestinian pollster Khalil Shikaki, who is professor of political science and director of the Palestine Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah, Palestine. Since 2005, he has also been a senior fellow at the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. This Week in Palestine recorded this presentation at Harvard University. Dr. Shikaki, for over 25 years, has been measuring public opinion in both Palestine and Israel, especially as it relates to the peace process, with a focus lately on opinion concerning the two-state solution. This is a PowerPoint presentation which puts us, as a radio audience, at a bit of a disadvantage, but his research findings are clearly articulated, which makes the recording relevant for broadcast on This Week in Palestine. Here is Dr. Khalil Shikaki speaking at Harvard University.
I started survey research among Palestinians some 25 years ago, almost 25 years ago. So the title of my talk is about 25 years after Oslo. So over the last 25 years, I have been assessing where the Palestinian public is with regard to support for the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, and in particular for the support for the two-state solution and support for the various compromises that are entailed in a two-state solution. A lot of this work was also done jointly with Israeli colleagues. Since 2000, for the last 19 years, this work was done with the Hebrew University. Right now it is continuing with Tel Aviv University. Part of it was also conducted jointly with the Israel Democracy Institute. We've been trying to assess where the two publics are and how the two publics see each other, and the impact of one's own perception of the other side on one's own willingness to support compromise and the two-state solution. So I'll show a few slides in a minute. These slides that I'll show come from the more recent findings. These recent findings are based on research that is ongoing. For the last 3 years, jointly with colleagues from Tel Aviv University, we've been trying to explore the question of to what extent we can reverse attitudes among the two publics. And the reason we ask about reversibility of attitudes is because since Oslo, during the last 25 years, particularly during the last 10 years, attitudes on both sides, Israelis and Palestinians, have become more hardline. I'll give you an example. 25 years among the Palestinians, our findings have shown that 80% of the Palestinians were in favor of a two-state solution. Today, slightly more than 40% support the two-state solution. 10 years ago, in 2008, close to 70% were still supporting a two-state solution. In 2008, support for a comprehensive agreement, a peace, permanent peace agreement that would entail all kinds of concessions from both sides. This package was based on ongoing negotiations at that time between the Palestinian president and the Israeli prime minister. The current Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, was that president, and the Israeli prime minister was Ehud Olmert. We presented both sides with a one-page summary of the talks that were ongoing at that time. These surveys, in fact, were conducted for the benefit of these two men, so that they can see, as they negotiate, how much of the public was willing to support their ideas. And I can tell you, at that time, we were able, in August 2008, to present both men with a one-page summary of a permanent agreement that had the support of more than 60% of the Palestinians and more than 60% of Israeli Jews. Support among Israeli Arabs was 90%. Support among Israeli Arabs for a very similar package today is also 90%. But support among Israeli Jews and Palestinians today is about 40%, slightly less, somewhere between 37 to 40%. So you can see the decline, not only in terms of the support for the concept of the two-state solution, the idea that there would be two states between the river and the sea, a state of Palestine living side by side with the state of Israel, in peace, security, and cooperation. This idea is no longer the idea supported by the majority when presented the way I've just outlined it. A package that entails the same concessions that Israelis and Palestinians were contemplating in 2008 does not have a majority support. So 3 years ago, we decided to explore this question: is this reversible? First of all, we wanted to know why this is happening. Why do we see a decline in support for the two-state solution? Why is it happening among the two sides at the same time, with the exception of Israeli Arabs? The exception of the Israeli, there has been absolutely no change among Israeli Arabs in support for the concept or support for the various concessions. So every time now, if I forget to say Jews, when I say Israelis, it means Israeli Jews. As I said, Israeli Arabs, although we continue to study them, but there is absolutely no need, as far as this question is concerned, the reversibility issue that I'm addressing. Israeli Arabs do not need their attitudes to be reversed. So we wanted to know why this is happening. We wanted to know what issues in particular are causing this change. We wanted to know what constituencies in particular are leading the demand for hardline attitudes. Which constituencies on both sides are, quote-unquote, problematic? The findings show that one common theme on both sides is the idea of feasibility or viability. Both sides have been influenced by the same forces. For the Palestinian side in particular, this has been more serious than it has been for the Israeli Jewish side. And that is the belief that the two-state solution is no longer viable, that settlement construction throughout the West Bank is making it impossible to separate the two people, the two sides, into two separate states. This particular conclusion is not only influenced by facts on the grounds that the state of Israel creates in the West Bank, and including Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, but also by other developments. when President Trump was elected, the impact on the question of viability was very negative. When he last December, a year ago, decided to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, the same thing happened. Public perception, surprisingly, on both sides, went in the same direction. Even though the Israelis liked what the fact that Trump was elected, they also liked the fact that he moved the embassy. But they made the same conclusion as the Palestinians, that the election of Trump and the decision regarding Jerusalem will make it impossible for Palestinians and Israelis to reach an agreement on a two-state solution, based on a two-state solution. This is not the only reason. Over the years since Oslo, there has been significant erosion in the level of trust between Palestinians and Israelis. The level of trust today is close to zero. About 10% of all Palestinians say they trust Israeli Jews. We're not talking about the Israeli government, we're talking about Israeli Jews, people of Israel. This has been accumulating over the years. There's no doubt that the years of the failure of Oslo after the election of Netanyahu in 1996, and then the re-election of Netanyahu in 2009, and during the last 9 years, the perception that the Israeli government is not interested in peace has also grown significantly. But along with the perception that the Israelis are not interested in peace, by the way, we see the same thing evolving among Israeli Jews as well. Most Israeli Jews believe Palestinians are not interested in peace, do not support a two-state solution, just like the majority of the Palestinians do not believe that Israeli Jews want peace with the Palestinians or that they support a two-state solution. What is more alarming is the perception of the Palestinians, how the perception of the Palestinians of Israel's long-term aspirations have evolved over these years. Today, close to 80% of the Palestinians believe Israel's long-term aspiration is to take away Palestinian land and expel the population or deny them their civil rights. More than 52% in the last survey said Israel wants to take away the land and expel the population. We have never had such findings during the last 25 years. The last 10 years in particular have seen a significant increase in the perception of those who view Israel's long-term aspirations as an existential threat to the Palestinians. Again, I don't have to say it, the same thing has also been happening among Israeli Jews, and it has also been having a similar impact on their attitude. There is one more issue that has nothing to do with Israel that has also contributed to the decline in support for the idea of a two-state solution and the compromises entailed, and that is public perception of state-building failures, internal Palestinian failures, the failure to create a democracy, the failure to create an independent judiciary, free press, an accountable political system, fight corruption. All these factors have been playing out during all these years, but in particular during the last 10 years, we have seen significant increase in public perception that the Palestinian elite, the ruling elite, is a corrupt authoritarian elite, and that if this elite creates a Palestinian state alongside the State of Israel, this state will also be corrupt and authoritarian, just another Arab corrupt and authoritarian country. The impact of this on most Palestinians is minor, but among the youth in particular, the impact is very significant. The younger you are, in our surveys, the youngest age group that we keep focusing on all the time is the 18 to 22. The 18 to 22 we take to represent the idealists in Palestinian society. And it is this particular group that today has zero confidence that a future Palestinian state will be democratic or free of corruption. This age group believes that the entire Palestinian elite is corrupt and authoritarian, will always be corrupt and authoritarian. The future state will also be corrupt and authoritarian. Therefore, we do not need to have a Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel. Instead, we should have one state in the entire land between the river and the sea. A one-state solution is today the demand, is the idea that is winning support among the Palestinian youth. It's not just the 18 to 22. It is supported by a significant number of Palestinians from other age groups as well. Even the 50 and above supports the two-state solution. The one-state solution. And the reason is very clear. For most Palestinians, the status quo is untenable. People want to change it. Unlike the Israelis, in the surveys that we conduct jointly, we ask both sides to assess the status quo. And you won't be surprised to see that settlers who live in the West Bank and East Jerusalem are the group that is most satisfied with the status quo. More than 75% of settlers say things are good or very good. Among Israelis within the Green Line, the perception that things are good or very good is more than 60%. Israeli Arabs, about 50% say things are good or very good. Among Palestinians in the West Bank, however, 20% or less say things are good or very good. And if you go to Gaza, it's less than 5% who say things are good or very good. So the Israelis can afford to maintain the status quo. In fact, the status quo is the most preferred outcome for most Israeli Jews, not for Palestinians. And not particularly for the youth who want to see a future for themselves. And so the future that they today define as the preferred future is a one-state solution. Instead of fighting for sovereignty and independence, like other nationalists in Palestinian society, the youth prefer to fight for equal rights. Why is this happening? Is one question that we've been asking. Why do we see this erosion in support? Why is the Palestinian Authority failing to deliver on state building? There are some very positive things within the Palestinian Authority that should encourage people to support the two-state solution. There's no doubt that the Palestinian president is committed to a two-state solution, so the Palestinian leadership continues to declare its commitment to a two-state solution. Abbas is also committed to nonviolence. There is no doubt that he is probably the most dovish Palestinian leader that exists today. And there is no doubt that when he's gone, he's 84, the next Palestinian president and the next Palestinian leadership will definitely be less dovish and moderate than Abbas. The political party that Abbas is leading is most supportive of a two-state solution. In our surveys, 80% of those who tell us that they will vote for Fatah in the next elections support the two-state solution and support compromises entailed in any permanent peace agreement. So Abbas and the political party that he leads are in favor of a two-state solution. The PA has very strong and effective security services that have been able to enforce law and order and works very closely with the Israelis through security coordination to ensure peace and quiet. Which is essential if there is any peace agreement in the future. The ability of the Palestinian security services. When Oslo was signed, there was no Palestinian security sector to address issues related to enforcing the agreement. It wasn't until later in the 90s, in the late 90s, that the security services began to function as an effective force. And then during the Second Intifada, the security services were almost totally decimated by the violence. And it was then security reform and reconstruction of the security sector took place starting in 2007. And today, the Palestinian security services are more professional and effective than they have been at any other time. But there is zero accountability for the Palestinian security sector. And the Palestinian security services, in the absence of an accountable political system, is able to make it extremely difficult for a free press to flourish, for Palestinian civil society to function independently of the government and the PA. And this is creating a significant erosion in confidence. Add to that the split between the West Bank and Gaza, which, in addition to the disunity it creates, the perception of disunity among Palestinians, is also making it impossible to hold elections. The last time Palestinians had presidential elections was 2005, parliamentary elections 2006, which means that the electoral term of both the president and the parliament have expired a long time ago. Without electoral legitimacy, there is very little confidence and trust in Abbas or the government. In 2018, surveys that we've conducted have shown somewhere between 60 to 70% of the public demanding the resignation of the president. Only 25% of the public believes that the president has credibility. Most believe the entire PA lacks legitimacy. The demand for elections is very high, but most Palestinians do not want to go to elections before the reunification of the West Bank and Gaza. The reunification of the West Bank and Gaza is something that is considered by the Palestinians as a top priority. National unity trumps democracy among Palestinians. And so the challenge is not only to get rid of occupation, to reach a peace agreement with Israel, but also to create a political system that is accountable, democratic, and to unify the Palestinian people. These challenges have been making it more and more difficult for the Palestinians, therefore, to address the question of the two-state solution in a manner that can lead to greater willingness to compromise. One issue that we have been focused on throughout these years is to try to understand the value system. Is it possible that the hardening of attitudes that we witness is the outcome of change in the value system of the Palestinians? Value system change could have significant impact. Value system can change due to increased religiosity, for example. Ideology becomes more and more important in people's thinking. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that during the last 10 years, there is no evidence in our surveys that there has been any change in the value system of the Palestinians. We have seen a change in the value system, and we know how to measure it, between the mid-90s and all the way up to 2005, 2006, and the change during this period led to a rise in Islamism in Palestinian society, ultimately leading to the electoral victory of Hamas in 2006. Since then, there has been absolutely no change in the value system. It has not changed at all. We have essentially three competing ideas. Islamism, the one I've mentioned already, nationalism, or secular nationalism, and the left, who are also nationalists, but distinguish themselves from the nationalists in by rejecting religion. Islamists tend to be religious. They tend to believe that state and religion go hand in hand and tend to define themselves as Muslims first and foremost in terms of their identity. Nationalists tend to be less religious or not religious. They tend to believe in the separation between state and religion, although they have a great deal of respect for religion and will allow certain role for religion in personal affairs. And they will define themselves first and foremost as Palestinians. The left shares the same values as the other nationalists, but they believe that in terms of the role of religion, religions should be eradicated. It should not have any role in the socio-political life of the Palestinians. In terms of the distribution, during the last 10 years, Islamists have had the support of about Islamism, that is the idea, has been embraced by about 30% of the Palestinian public. Secular nationalism has the support of about 55% of the public, and 15% are what you would call the left. Not to be confused with American left, though. These terms are sometimes not very useful in various contexts. I have the same problem when talking about Israeli left and compare the Israeli left with the Palestinian left. So if it is not the value system, a change in the value system, then what had caused the change? Well, I've outlined what I believed were the causes for the change. They are essentially pragmatic considerations. So in the last 3 years, we've been testing this idea that it is pragmatic considerations that has been the reason for the hardening of attitudes. And that in order to soften attitudes, what we need to do is to find ways to overcome these difficulties. For example, neutralize the impact of the lack of feasibility. And we've tested various ideas. We presented Israelis and Palestinians with ideas for a permanent status agreement. We've asked them what they think about the various elements of such an agreement. A package. It's not just the concept of a two-state solution, but a detailed package of compromises for a two-state solution. And we asked them whether they would support them and whether they would support the entire package. For those who said no, they will not support it, which is the majority. We asked them whether they would be willing to change their mind under certain conditions. And we, over the last 3 years, presented the Palestinians and the Israelis, each side, with about 30 such measures. We call them incentives. These incentives are presented as the ways and means of changing attitudes regarding the package of compromises. It's an experiment. What we find is that our hypothesis that the hardening of attitude can be reversed without having to address the value system or the basic beliefs of the two societies is indeed correct. We then take some of these incentives that we have tested and we present them to the public in a revised package. The revised package, then, this is taken from the joint Israeli-Palestinian surveys that we are conducting with Tel Aviv University. And this, what you are looking at, are the findings from June of this year. What you see in blue is the original package that we have presented, and what you see in red
is the modified package. I'll show you at the end what are the terms of each one and what are the differences between the two. And this is just a glimpse. It looks at both sides, the Israelis, and as you can see right there at the end is Israeli Arabs with the 90% support that I've mentioned earlier. You can see Gazans actually have more support for the package than West Bankers. But you can also see that the support among Palestinians, all of the Palestinians, for the original package was not more than 37%. For Israeli Jews was not more than 39%, very close to each other. But as you can look at the red, you can see that the modification introduced, remember these modifications were introduced for both sides. So we've added to the package we have presented on both sides, and we were able to change the attitude, positively change the attitudes for both sides. I've selected Gaza, West Bank, Jews and Arabs to focus on, but in fact, if you look at every other demographic or non-demographic indicators, you will find that in each and every case, there has been a significant change for each and every group, even the most hardliners. If you take Hamas supporters, you would see a change from the original to the modified. If you take the ultra-Orthodox or the right-wing in Israel, you'll also see the same change. If you take the youth, the 18 to 22 that I've mentioned earlier, or take the Israeli youth, who are also hardliners, you'll also find the same trend that we are able to increase the level of support significantly. This is the work of the 3 years. So the findings regarding the most recent one in June essentially reflects what has been happening, although the trend is more negative over the years, over the last 2.5 years. And these are the components. If you look at the list from 1 to 9, this is both the original and the modified. The modified package included a 12-point plan. So the last three are new elements that were introduced based on the testing that we have conducted with the incentives. The first 9 are the classical permanent status issues for any of you who have been looking into Israeli-Palestinian peace. The elements from 1 to 9 are always there. And so we focused on those initially. After testing, we decided to add 10, 11, and 12. Democratic Palestine, for example, we have discovered from the experiments with the incentives that a future democratic Palestine turned out to be very effective, not only for Palestinians, and particularly for Palestinian youth, but also very effective for Israeli Jews as well. And so when we included it, it positively affected attitudes on both sides, similarly with the other issues. I'm trying not to focus on the substance, just to focus on our methodology and the outcome of that methodology. This shows what happens when we take into consideration the modified plan that we have presented to both sides. Although the plan we presented gave Israeli Jews more to their liking, less for Palestinians, but overall, the new elements that we introduced had a significant impact on Palestinian support and Palestinian willingness to compromise. Similarly, you can see with the added elements, we increased the components of the package that had least conflict attributes in it. Before that, we only had 2 elements in which there were least conflict from both sides. Okay, so here's an idea of what the incentives are. What you are looking at are the top incentives to Israeli Jews. These are incentives. We've tested 30 incentives. and what you're looking at are the top 10. You're looking at an incentive and you're looking at a percentage. The incentive is offered to those, only those, who say no to the package. These are not people who said no to the concept of the two-state solution. These are people who said no to the package that implements a two-state solution. And the percentage is the percentage of those from the hardliners who said no, who changed their mind and said, I will support your package. And the package here is the original package that in the last survey had only 39% of Israeli Jews in favor. So if you add to that the 47, the most popular incentive for Israeli Jews was the idea that they would be able to continue to visit the Temple Mount or Al-Haram Sharif. 47% of Israeli Jews who said no to the package said, if you give me guarantees that I can do that, I'll change my mind and support your package. And that applies to everything else that you see here. Not everything, as you can see in the package, in the incentives, not everything here is tangible gains. And not everything is a zero-sum incentive. Some are not zero-sum. The state of Palestine will be democratic is not a zero-sum, as it turned out to be. And some are intangible. The Palestinian recognition of Israel as a Jewish state and recognition of the Jewish historic and religious ties to the land is also intangible. And these are the 10 top incentives for the Palestinians. Again, remember, these incentives are only offered to those who say no to the package. They are not offered to those who say yes. And the percentage is the percentage of those from among the hardliners who now change their mind in favor of the package if it contains this item. One item at a time. We do not offer more than one item at a time. We basically say, you've said no, now I'm going to offer you this. For example, number one, the top most important was Israel releases all Palestinian prisoners. 56% of all hardliners said they will change their mind and support the package. We presented the original package if it contains this incentive. And here too, you see some that are not tangible at all. Number 10, Israel acknowledges responsibility for the refugee problem. Israel say apologizing for the suffering of the refugees, for example, is an intangible incentive that had a strong impact. The state of Palestine will be democratic is a non-zero-sum incentive. Marwan Barghouti supporting the package is also a non-zero-sum incentive. And each and every one of those, by the way, a single incentive was sufficient to give us a majority for the package. However, there is a problem. There are a lot of zero-sum incentives here. And so if you offer if you offer the Israelis incentives that Palestinians, we know Palestinians will not accept, we know the percentage will then change. How do we deal with that? Well, we decided to test what we call the pairing of the incentives. You saw earlier how we took the non-zero-sum elements and added them to create a modified plan. Before going further, we wanted to test what happens if we actually included zero-sum incentives, not just non-zero-sum incentives. So we created these paired incentives. These are 8 paired incentives. Together, these are 16 incentives. 8 were offered to Israeli Jews, 8 were offered to Palestinians. We now, in June of this year, we decided to pair them. We'll tell the Palestinians, Israel will give you the release of prisoners, for example, and in return, this is what the Palestinians will have to do. We say to Israeli Jews, the Palestinians, for example, will end the boycott. But Israel will then have to do something for the Palestinians. But we have not integrated these yet in the plan, the modified plan that we present. Instead, we wanted to test the viability of these pairs. How do we test the viability? Well, we present the two sides, the entire population, not just the hardliners, but the entire population, those who said yes and those who said no to the original package. We asked them about each and every one of those paired incentives. And we asked them, what would be the impact if this was included in the package? Would you still support the package? Or would you change your mind and oppose it? And if you opposed it, what would your reaction be if it is included? Would you change your mind and support it? And this is the finding for the Israeli Jewish population. What you're looking at is each and every one of the paired incentives. This is the starting point, the initial support. The initial support and opposition to the original package. 39% support, if you recall, from the first slide I showed. And this is what happens if we take each and every paired incentive. Six out of the eight incentives, as you can see, look at the red line. The red line is the base. So this is the point of departure. If we go beyond that, and we go beyond that here, and all the way to the end, it means this paired incentive is successful. But this is only half of the story, and it's half of the story because we need to see what happened to the Palestinians. And here's what happened with the Palestinians. We're not as successful with the Palestinians. Only two out of the eight were effective with the Palestinians. So there is a problem with the pairing process. The pairing process is not physics. It's not an exact science. It's trial and error. And so what we need to do is to find the right pairs in order to, and that requires testing. And this is what we are currently doing, to test various pairs, see what works with one side and what works with the other side, and see if we can combine what works and avoid what doesn't work in order to obtain what we would call as balanced efficiency. Balanced on both sides and efficiency that we are able to increase the level of support. This, by the way, was the original plan. Again, I'm not going to get into this. This is my last slide. The next one is the last slide. And this is the modified plan that we have been working with. But again, I'm not focused on the substance per se, but rather on this idea that I started with, which is the hardening of attitudes that we see among Palestinians and, as you can see, among Israeli Jews, is it reversible? And at what cost? What would it take to reverse the hardening of attitudes that we have seen, particularly during the last 10 years? And the answer is, we can reverse the attitudes, and it doesn't really require a change in the values of either side. And thank you very much.
So, only a question or two from me, because I'd like to turn to the audience. This is a very meaty presentation. And unlike so many discussions of these issues, it's a pleasure to see data behind what you say. I'm sure everyone in the room has deep substantive backing for whatever their opinions are, but what we see is intriguing. I'm first impressed with that. The second thing is that it isn't necessary to have a conversion on each side of underlying values to find pragmatic possibilities. because there's a sense in many quarters that there's just such ideological polarization and opposition that nothing could potentially bridge the gap. And I love what you've done in classic negotiation terms to find high-value, low-cost possibilities, because that's where gains can be found, and that's how gaps can be bridged. And this is intriguing. So you've really offered a roadmap, although that's a loaded word in this context, but a set of steps that could move things in a positive direction for those who might want to do so. And I think that's a big caveat here. One thing that you said initially, and that even now in a relatively lower support on each side for a two-state solution, it has, of course, that support has been much higher earlier. There's been the support, but there's been something else, which is we support it, but we don't trust the other side to carry through.
Yes.
And so that's been, we want it, but they don't, and that was a sort of a mirror image. What I wonder about this set of paired incentives, which is fascinating, is if you were to offer these, would that overcome the trust issue? Whereas before people said, we're in favor, but we don't trust. Someone might say, we're in favor of this package, but we don't trust. And I'd be curious if you could address that question.
It is extremely difficult to restore trust. We've tried to find ways. The beauty of having a joint survey is that we can ask both sides simultaneously questions about each other, and we can ask them to speculate as to what is the attitude of their own neighbors in their own community, and what is the attitude on the other side. So we can obtain information about what the public wants, and we can also obtain information about the normative view of the public. The normative view is different from public opinion. The normative view is what you and I think about the views in this room. If somebody asks you, what do you think most people sitting in this room think about something, that is the normative view of the audience. But as a pollster, if I ask each and every one of you, what do you think about this or that issue, I can get a sense of the public, prevailing public opinion among, but I can also ask this side to speculate about the attitudes on this side and this side about the attitudes on the other side, which we have been continuously doing. And what we are continuously confronted with, even after we overcome the difficulties, is that people do not change their mind about the their assessment of what is the prevailing attitudes. So it is, and the picture is very grim. We basically find, in the good old days when we had a majority of 60% in favor of a package, for example, we would ask, what do you think the majority view on your side? And only 50% will say a majority on my side will support the package. And if we said, what is the majority view on the other side? And the finding will show that only 20% think a majority on the other side supports the package, which we've just found 60% in fact supported. So this collective ignorance or misperception of each other, of their own community and of each other, is a very serious impediment to restoring trust. I can't find a way through survey research to restore trust. I give up. But I think leaders can. So, but my conclusion means the following. It means, one, that public opinion is not a force for peace. It cannot be a force for peace because of the distrust. Even if my findings are beautiful, they show I can easily overcome the hardening of attitudes, but I cannot overcome trust, the distrust. If leaders, however, decide to overcome trust, if leaders lead, if Abbas and Netanyahu meet tonight and decide to make peace, and go tomorrow to their publics and say, we have a plan, we've just signed this agreement. Our findings say public opinion is not an impediment to peace. So it is not a force for peace, but it's not an impediment to peace.
You have been listening to Dr. Khalil Shikaki, eminent Palestinian pollster and political scientist, speaking at Harvard University. Our time is up, so we will sign off for this week. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.